This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to Pressing Matters. I'm Shahad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh. Today, our guest is Leslie Lopez, regional correspondent for the Straits Times Singapore, to be distinguished from the new Straits Times, though I think they had some common origin. I think that's the way to put it. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, we know that you've been covering the general elections and the aftermath, and but before we get to the story that you wrote that really intrigued us about the changeover, I just want to ask you, because you've been around for absolutely decades, and I say that with utmost respect, absolute decades that you've been around, did you expect this to happen, and to what extent do you, and perhaps you can tell us what you think actually happened on May 9th?
Well, before this fly-on-the-wall story that I did about how the power handover took place, I did a separate piece listing down four possible scenarios on how the election would pan out, because it was shaping up to be a contest too close to call. And I was very much leaning towards a very narrow win for the BN or a hung parliament. Now, clearly, I was wrong with the narrow win, but we came close to a hung parliament situation. I guess the suspense began at about 9 p.m. when results started coming in, and the guys in Pakatan Harapan were telling me that, you know, victory was very likely. So I got back to the guys in Barisan, and all I got was, I think we should wait for the election commission to officially declare the results. That kind of told me there was panic. So I started to work the phones on the Pakatan Harapan side, because I felt that for this thing to work and to happen, the coalition needed to stay together. And this was really the big challenge. And what was intriguing, interesting, covering this thing was that the groups that were involved in these, you know, in staging these confidence-building measures among the various parties, to get them to stay together was really very, very, I think, pleasant, actually. You know, for Malaysia. The other thing that I think was crucial was how they reached the Duli Yang Maha Mulia Agong for that early morning meeting with Wan Aziza. And you know, just that this thing happened without any incident is just a wonderful, was wonderful reporting exercise. I very much put down on print what I could confirm with at least two sources. What I couldn't, I left it out of the story.
Well, Leslie, you said that panic was spreading fast in Najib's camp, and one close advisor to the former PM told the Straits Times that other options were being looked at. What were they, and how did they read the tide so wrongly?
Well, you know, I guess change, always change, you know, happens when you least expect it, and there's no difference in this case. As it got closer to the election day, the BN's internal projections from the lofty target of two-thirds at one point, came down to 130 and then to 120. And just before elections, they said we could be looking at a hung parliament. So among the options, I guess, that were being considered was how UMNO and the BN could forge a working relationship with some of the parties that would have got a sizable number of seats. There was already talk that, you know, before the elections, there were backdoor channels, negotiations with the DAP, the Kadilan. Those were the rumors at that point. Mm. So I guess clearly the hung parliament situation was an option that was being considered.
And you did mention PAS, because you would have thought PAS was the more likely partner for Barisan Nasional, especially because they, one, claimed that they wanted to play kingmaker, and two, they already had an existing bipartisan approach to the Sharia Court Amendments Act, and there were, of course, rumours of money being used, and, you know, the fact that PAS had fielded so many candidates. The question was where the money was coming from for candidates who are clearly going to lose their deposit.
Well, I think why I didn't mention PAS was because for this thing to work, the BN and UMNO would have had to get one of the sizable parties, which is either PKR or DAP, to make this thing, let this thing fly. So that may have been the reason why Dr. Sri Anwar said that Najib called him twice that night. Well, I don't know, but I'm just speculating.
Yeah, he did, right? Interesting, you know, because if you remember in the, I think, introduction of preface to Kalimullah Hassan's book, his collection of essays and columns, he does mention that there were voices in the Abdullah Ahmad Badawi camp at cabinet who wanted to thwart a transfer of power. And, you know, the suggestion there that they would be willing to engage in violence in order to do so. Now, was that one of the possible scenarios?
Certainly not. I think this was something that everyone didn't expect, but it was very clear that Malaysians wanted ownership of their country and government, which I think is only a good thing that we can.
Well, Leslie, earlier your story that talked about how power changed hands within 24 hours from Najib to Mahathir, what other behind-the-scenes things? Because you described it as tense and suspenseful. So what was happening at that hour?
Well, like I said earlier, there was a lot of this confidence-building measures because each side was trying to make sure that they stuck together. And there is no running away from there is some unhappiness about Mahathir's lead role. There was unhappiness also that he was taking such a leadership position when his party had the least number of seats in the coalition. So all of this was being played out, you know, different factions trying to come together. But what was suspenseful for me was how people were moving in those early hours of the morning and right through the day on May 10th to keep this thing together, actually. And that they did, and they did it. I mean, I think that's remarkable.
You know, there's in some circles, they use the expression the deep state. And the idea is that the deep state had at some point decided that Najib Razak had to go. And, you know, the question is and how to remove him without sort of dismantling the whole system. I mean, when you look at what's happened, do you see something akin to a revolution, something or simply a change of power in order to get rid of this one man who certain people in the deep state or in the establishment felt was in fact hurting the system? Do you think we're poised for a return to business as usual once everything calms down, or do you think we'll be able to get through the kind of institutional reform agenda that actually suggests that something profound is going to happen and change in Malaysian society and politics?
I would subscribe to the latter, actually, because if there was a deep state, then UMNO would have stayed in power without Najib. But clearly this was a complete overhaul. What we're seeing today, you know, the setting up of various task force with, you know, senior people in these things, very, very vocal people, I think shows that there is this genuine intention to want to create some change, you know, and snap us back of this not so pleasant trajectory that the country was on.
We're speaking to Leslie Lopez, regional correspondent for The Straits Times Singapore. We'll be back with a deeper look at the politics of our time. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning and welcome back to Pressing Matters. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh, and our guest this morning, Leslie Lopez, regional correspondent for The Straits Times. Oh, we've been talking about the general election. We're talking about the transfer of power. Leslie, I wonder if we can begin by asking you about the way in which UMNO in particular, and you're a long-time watcher of, you know, UMNO and Barisan Nasional, how they are creating a story or their narrative about what happened. We've had the Prime Minister come out to say that he thinks this was their defeat was based on lies that were spread against him and his government. It was a perception problem. Do you think they understand fully what was going on the ground and why Malaysians, including UMNO voters, stayed away from the polls? In that instance, at least UMNO voters stayed away from the polls.
I think clearly there was a disconnect between Putrajaya and the ordinary Malaysians, particularly the Malay community. That's clear, I think, from this election. Why they didn't catch it is certainly a mystery, you know, given the amount of money that was spent, the number of operatives that they had, and they didn't see this clearly is a huge mystery. But I think what is gratifying is that people actually went out and did the unexpected. And I think that is something that as a reporter I'm still trying to come to terms with. I've covered political change in, you know, places like Indonesia and Thailand, all riveting stuff. But I never thought I'd have the luxury of doing it in my country and as a Malaysian. Certainly not in my lifetime, at least. But the fact that it happened, I think, is just very gratifying.
And what was the role of media? Did the media fail Najib? Did Najib's media fail him by not being able to reflect what was actually happening on the ground? You know, speaking truth to power, whatever you like, expression you like, just informing him that the ground was shifting rapidly from under his feet.
Well, I think all of them clearly were operating in their own silos. No one was wanting to hear or listen to bad news or negative news. But, you know, a lot of us saw this thing happening. What we didn't know was, or underestimated, was it would be enough. The anger, the public displeasure would be enough to actually bring about this change.
Well, speaking about news and change, I think 1MDB was definitely one piece of news that has, caused the call for change. And Leslie, you were covering the story as it unfolded many years back. How do you think the story will end?
Well, actually, covering 1MDB has been a challenge and will continue to be a challenge. I think, Joyce, you remember before the media frenzy in 2015, I was running this media experiment with a local publishing house that produced a digital regional news magazine. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a story that I would think sort of like was groundbreaking on 1MDB. It ran in the magazine cover with the heading Malaysia's $12 billion hot potato. We got a lot of flack and a lot of kudos for that story. And we actually won best reporting, business reporting in 2014. From SOPA, the Society of Asian Publishers, for business excellence, actually, in that report. I think we broke a business story at that point, but it mushroomed into a political nightmare for Malaysia, you know, and for Najib. I'm not sure how this is going to end, but I do know that the problem won't go away because the country and us as Malaysians will have to honour these debt obligations.
Hmm. Well, you've been writing 1MDB stories for Straits Times as well in the couple of years. And earlier this year, there were critics that some 1MDB stories were planted. Your comments on this?
Well, you know, our stories have all been what we were leading the coverage, what was going to happen. And these stories have proven correct. They may not be part of somebody's narrative, you know, but that doesn't mean... But we stood by our stories and our stories remain correct. You know, I won't back away. I'm proud of the coverage that we've done. We stood our ground and, you know, we've been accurate.
Now, you live in Petaling Jaya. I know this for a fact. And not far from where you live is Padang Timor, where Anwar Ibrahim, gave his speech the day he was released. Were you there?
Yes, I was there.
And this must have been an extraordinary moment because you've followed this man. I know you were reporting during the time when there were tensions between him and then Dr. Mahathir. This new relationship they have, kind of transports many of us from our generation back 20 or so years. What do you think is going to happen? Do you expect to see a reasonably stable relationship going forward? Do you think those two men have changed so dramatically in the intervening years that they're not going to repeat the same mistakes that they made 20 years ago?
Well, you know, there's a lot of baggage, but the fact that these two men have come together in this fashion is extraordinary. You know, Anwar has been in and out since 1998, and we've covered him before. But in Malaysia, it's always been the story's always been about a Mahathir-Anwar combo, you know. It's either mutual respect, friendly competition, or just pure bad blood, you know. So I think that's going to shape this thing in the coming months. We hope that it'll be a lot more of the mutual respect and friendly competition, you know. And hopefully the bad blood is something of the past.
I mean, there's still a lot of rumors that saying that while Anwar said that he, you know, is not seeking office anytime soon, he's going to give Mahathir the space, there also talk that behind the scenes there might be jostling and, you know, and so on and so forth, and that, you know, the statement made by Rafizi Ramli is a symptom of that jostling. What do you make of this? And is that a story that you're going to be following?
It certainly is a story that we're following. I wrote a story on Sunday which talked about how can these two guys pull together for this new Malaysia. And I think there is always going to be this jostling. You know, people will be suspicious of each camp. We've got personalities that, you know, magnets of controversy with the Anwar camp like Daim. And I think these things will always be there. The question will be Anwar's challenge to rein in his boys, and also Mahathir's challenge to keep this relationship, you know, on even keel.
Well, Leslie, you've been covering Dato' Sri Anwar for many, many years, as Sharad was saying. And what was it like covering him, and what do you expect from him now that he's a free man?
Well, you know, he's always good copy. He's always good copy. He's a Democrat. I think he wants to be liked, which is a good thing, you know, and that forces the ground or sort of to play to the ground. So, and I think this new Malaysia where Malaysians want ownership of, are demanding ownership of their government, ownership of their leaders, this is a good thing. And, you know, it'll be interesting to watch how the new Dato' Sri Anwar, after two jail experiences, you know, comes out and leads this country.
You know, one of the things, Leslie, that Anwar said at Padang Timur was he kind of gave, and he's well known for this, a kind of universalist Islamic vision of the state and so on and so forth. And remember, he talked about the universal message behind Ramadan and fasting. But the side story for GE14 is really past, isn't it? In many ways, analysts are saying they got the better of UMNO in the purported deal between the two. They've got two states now. They almost went into a coalition in two other states. They were kind of playing kingmaker. Hadi Awang, and some people say, was vindicated, leaving Pakatan Rakyat and striking on his own. Are you watching the past story?
Well, actually, I grew up in Kelantan, and I visited Kelantan before the elections. One of the first stories I did in the elections was that I actually predicted that PAS would lose and that UMNO had made gains in Kelantan and they would retain Terengganu. So I originally was of the view that PAS would be the biggest loser in this election, and with UMNO making some gains in places like Kelantan but probably losing out in Sabah. But I suspect that clearly from the results, the anti-UMNO sentiment clearly lifted the PAS boat here. You know, that led them to win in keep Kelantan and also win in Terengganu and give them quite a number of seats elsewhere.
And so is this a story, I mean, do you think strategically that this is also going to be a dynamic that changes the nature of politics in Malaysia? Because we're all focused on the centre ring. We're all focused on Pakatan Harapan versus Barisan Nasional. But PAS is playing at another game. And I'm wondering if you think this is significant.
I think it is significant. And I think what is going to be really crucial is how Dr. Mahathir deals with this thing. You know, he's no fan of the party. And he's come out very boldly, even in the run-up to the elections, which we thought some said could hurt their chances actually. But Dr. Mahathir stayed firm, and you know, so I think how he deals with this, the past issue, will be crucial.
Well, the changing political backdrop aside, how do you think the media landscape will evolve and play out in this new Malaysia? You've been in the industry for decades. You've worked with Reuters, Wires, print as well, local
Leslie,
media houses.
Light FM had Ambika Srinivasan on. I mean, what's going to happen to BFM?
Well, I just hope our government allows for the makings of a robust and responsible media, especially at a time when social media can be disruptive because they're not held to the same kind of standards and rigors that we are and in the media. So I think as long as they allow for that to happen and all of us take, just like Malaysians taking ownership of their country and leaders, we should take ownership of profession and do the right thing.
But there are media that's still owned by politically linked companies. They might be in shock, like many of those formerly of Barisan Nasional, or at least in the government. Do you think, apart from the cosmetic changes they make, the Star had Claire Rucastle Brown on the front page and not in a bad light, what do you think will really have to happen for media? I mean, do you think they have the wherewithal to change? Or are they saying, well, actually, it's just a five-year interim. We could be back in power 5 years from now. So let's stay with our former political masters.
Well, I think we should just leave them alone. We should leave them alone. Media companies rely on ad revenue. And it should not be because these companies are linked to the government that they draw these monies. But I think market forces must prevail. Good journalism will attract strong readership numbers and bring in the ads, whether it's from the government or the private sector. You know, so I think, you know, we all believe content is king, right? I mean, just like how you guys have great content now.
Great. Thank you so much, Leslie, for joining us this morning. We've been speaking to Leslie Lopez, regional correspondent for The Straits Times. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh, and this has been Pressing Matters. We're coming up to the news, and then we'll be back with Enterprise. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.